Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the RPM sub-team for EURES Providers Call on Thursday, 23rd of August 2018 at 12 UTC. On the call today, we have Phil Corwin, Justin Chu, and Susan Payne. We've received no apology. From staff, we have Ariel Yang, Julie Headland, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please remember to state your names before speaking for recording purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Phil.
Well, okay, I don't think I've usually led these calls, but I think this is for the sub-team members who are on the call to review the additional responses received from the three providers and to decide what, if anything, they mean in terms of recommendations, correct?
This is Ariel. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, then why doesn't staff just take us through the responses and we can, you know, I've taken a look at this chart prior, but in a quick way, and we can see what, if anything, we want to do about the additional information. Is that okay?
And this is Ariel. Yes, I can take the sub-teams through the table. So I would just start from the top. So basically, this table consolidates all the action items that we noted in the super consolidated table, and most of them are follow-up questions to the providers, and then there's a couple to the GDD. And so our task today is to look at their responses and think about the proposed suggestions to the full working group. So the first question or action item is for sub-team to ask AD and DRC to explain why they accept complaints that do not contain all the elements required in the URS Rule 3B. If you recall, the previous response they had is they accept complaints that do not contain all the required elements, but we suspect it may be a language issue. So their follow-up and then answer that they do not accept complaints that are not that are missing URS Rule 3B elements. And they have case managers that will check the information in accordance with the relevant URS rules, and they pay a special attention to language compliance of complaints. So it seems they do comply with the URS rules when they check the complaints. I'll pause.
Okay, so basically they've changed their answer. There was some misunderstanding prior. They comply with the policy in that regard. Had there been a prior suggestion? I guess, you know, the prior suggestion would have been to bring them into conformity, but it appears based on the revised answer that there's no reason to do that, that they are complying. Would that be a correct interpretation? And welcome, Michael. I see that you joined just after we got started. So it appears that since they're in compliance, there's no reason to make a suggestion. Would that be a logical conclusion?
This is Ariel from staff, and as Susan's typing, but based on staff understanding, that's the correct conclusion. And then Susan put in the chat, I think we thought that this might be a misinterpretation of the question, now corrected, so nothing to be done, I think. So she agrees with you.
All right. Well, unless anyone else has anything to say, I think, you know, if they're complying, there's no need to take any further action. So let's move on to the next one.
Thanks, Phil. This is Ariel. So the next action item is for a sub-team to obtain details from ADN-DRC and Forum on their administrative check to determine whether a domain name is already subject to an open and active URS or UDRP proceeding or court case. So the previous response ADN-DRC said is they do cross-check, and then we asked them to elaborate. And they didn't really elaborate. They just said at least they checked whether the same complaint has already been filled with another ADNDRC office. And for FORM, their response previously is they will check if there's a suspicion that trigger this. So we asked what would trigger their suspicion. And their response is most of the complainants are well-informed and abide by the rules. If there's a feeling from a new complainant or from a complainant that typically files with another provider, FORM's case coordinators search the other provider's website to determine if a case involving the same domain name is pending. And to FORM's knowledge, no disputed domain name was already subject to an open and active EOS UDRP proceeding or court case. So they don't think this was an issue. And that's on page 2 on the top.
Okay. Let me speak, and you know, anyone else can chime in. I'm not the font of all wisdom. It seems to me one, since, and I see Susan has her hand raised, so let me just speak, and then we can hear from her. It would be pretty rare for the same domain to be subject to two actions simultaneously, given that it's unlikely that the same trademark would be held by two different parties who would both bring some kind of complaint or legal action at the same time. Beyond that, if there is a response, the respondent's in the best position to say, hey, I'm already in the middle of another court case or UDRP or URS regarding the same domain. That said, is there anything we should do in terms of best practices from what we've seen that we should recommend should be a standard practice across all three providers in terms of this element? And Susan, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. I mean, I suppose there's a slight difference in approach from the different providers, but I've always felt in relation to this that the domain registrant is the person who's best placed to know if there's another action going on in another forum, and is what checks the providers do. They, you know, they could never be certain that they haven't missed something. So I don't think this is a non-point. I really do. I think, you know, if the registrant knows they're already being challenged in another forum, then they raise it and the case would get stopped. It also seems like it's never happened.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of would be in regard to another UDRP or URS action that there'd be some central, you know, registry maintained by ICANN where every UDRP and URS provider would be required when a case is filed to just, you know, send a notification. So there's basically a central database. So in terms of another UDRP or URS action, it would be simple for each of the providers to just go to that and say, you know, it would be listed by domain, and you could readily check. But that wouldn't help in terms of court cases because there's no way to check every jurisdiction in the world. You know, and again, so that's the only suggestion I would have. I don't know if anyone thinks we should make that, you know, ICANN establishing some central database for active UDRP and URS cases for terms for checking on this, but it might be overkill given the rarity of the situation and the fact that the registrant is the one who will always know. Further thoughts on that?
So Susan has her hand raised, and I also put myself in the queue.
Okay. Further thoughts, Susan?
Thank you. Yes. Well, I was going to say, I personally really do think that's overkill. I think it's, obviously it's an option, but it seems to me that would be quite onerous for ICANN and the providers, but particularly given that these proceedings are supposed to be, you know, quick and cheap, because it's not just a question of listing that there's an action, you know, that it would have to be updated at different stages of the action to ensure that the records that ICANN have are sort of live in real time and are not out of date. And I honestly, I think that it seems overkill. I think the registrant knows if they're already being challenged in another forum, and they can raise it or not as they choose.
Yeah, and before Ariel speaks, I would tend to agree. I mean, the URS, we're talking about less than a month from start to finish for the initial action, so you'd have to, you know, update, you'd have to put a notice into that database that the action was commenced, and then less than a month later, take it down. So we're talking about a very narrow window here. Ariel, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. And I'm not disagreeing with what Susan said, and I just want to point out that when MFSC responded to the same question, they provided a checklist they have for the administrative check, and it's not really involving what, you know, I can have to do with regard to the UDRP URS cases, but it's just the internal checklist an MFSC goes through to check whether the complaint is in compliance with the rules. So,
right, but did they say how they do that?
Yes, actually, there's an example they provided. I can put the link in the chat, and you can click on that and see it. It's a pretty simple document, and just basically a few checkboxes, but if the subteam decides to...
Right, but how do they actually do that check is what I'm asking. I mean, where do they go to see if there's another UDRP or URS against that particular domain?
They basically said some similar things like what Forum and ADNDRC said. They check the other providers' websites, and they also said they have difficulties finding certain court cases. If a domain name is subject to a court case, sometimes for certain jurisdictions they cannot find information. So similar responses.
All right. Well, I think at most we might suggest that the providers check the websites of the other URS and UDRP providers. I don't know how onerous that would be, but I wouldn't go any further than that. So why don't we go on to the next one, and noting we're already 17 minutes into the hour. We're on page 2, and there's a 10-page document. So maybe, Ariel, we can scan these quickly. I don't know if you have to read every word. We need to pick up the pace if we're going to get through the document. And this is a one-hour call, right?
And this is 90-minute call. But
90
minutes. Yes.
Okay. All right.
I will be mindful of the time.
Okay.
So the next action item is ask ADNDRC and Forum whether they accept any DOE complaints in light of the GDPR implementation, and also ask all three providers whether there's any other impact related to GDPR. So ADNDRC and Forum both said they accept the DOE complaint, and ADNDRC hasn't received any new complaints since GDPR implementation, but Forum did. They received 44 UIS complaints. And then Forum did express some of the issues, is that they think the registrant information, if it's masked, Forum is not yet able to add it to the complaint. And the registry rarely is able to provide the registrant information, and also only a handful of registrars were able to provide the complete contact details of the registrants. So they also agree with MFSD. They think some technical redesign of the U.S. filing process is required so that the complaint can be amended manually after filing. And I'm just reading through the table. And then Forum also expressed some other GDPR-related impacts. Registries are inconsistent with respect to how they would like to either receive verification requests or how Forum should receive the verification from them. And the inconsistency adds a significant amount of time to case handling. So this is their response. That's a page 3 and 2.
Okay. Well, my quick response to all this is one, They are accepting DOE complaints. That's consistent with the board's temporary specification related to GDPR. So the complaints are being accepted. Right now, URS is only for new TLDs. They're all SIC WHOIS registries, so the registries have the data. There's not a, we don't have an issue with SIN WHOIS like it, some of the legacies. And it seems to me that the one action item would be to work with the GDD and the registry stakeholder group to develop a consistent, uniform manner for providers to interact with registries. Those are my thoughts. Anyone else?
This is Sarah, not seeing any hands.
Okay, so I think the suggestion there is to work with GDD and registry stakeholder group to develop a uniform system for interaction between the providers and the registries, which shouldn't be that. Susan, sure, go ahead.
I think there might be another action item, which is this comment from the forum that there needs to be a kind of redesign of the filing process in order that they can amend the complaint. And I'm sorry, I don't know the rules well enough and I don't have them in front of me, but I think there may not be within the current process. I think it doesn't allow for the complaint to be amended. Maybe it's something that needs looking at anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's at least an action item for
okay.
us to look at it.
Well, maybe staff can look at the rules to see what the current rules are. But I think that along with a uniform, you know, working to develop a uniform system for interaction are operational fixes needed in light of GDPR, and I can't imagine they'd be controversial. So why don't we pencil those in?
This is Ariel from staff, and based on our recollection, that's correct. In the current rules, once a complaint is filed, they cannot be amended. That's why MFSD originally proposed that suggestion and forum agreed.
Okay.
And not seeing other hands, I will just keep going with the next action item. It's for step team to follow up with MFSD to request data evidence that support their claim about the difficulty in filing a DOE complaint. So that's on page 3 and 4. And MFSD said they heard this from less than 10 complainants, and then what they said is they would hardly file DOE complaints. They would delay filing URS complaints until they can access the WHOIS data prior to filing, or they had rather file UDRP because UDRP complaints might be amended. And the major part of the complaint in the filing with MFSD from European civil law systems and the common law concept of DOE complaint is unknown. So that's how they get the information that it's difficult to file DOE complaint.
Okay, Phil here. So we're seeing here with MFSD, since it's located in Europe, it's having the most problem because GDPR is an EU regulation. We can't change their legal system to one that's common law if they're civil law, but I think probably the one other thing I can think of is to communicate on this issue with the EPDP so that, you know, the ICANN group that's grappling with the temporary specification, so they're aware of this particular fallout with this European provider. Which, you know, so there's some things we can't, that are out of our bailiwick. We can't change the legal systems, and, you know, we've got another group dealing with the overall issue of GDPR and WHOIS, and they're going to do, they should be aware of what we're finding, but they're going to make the ultimate decisions. It's not in our jurisdiction. That's my thoughts.
This is Ariel. Nobody has raised hands, but I seen Susan is typing in the chat. And she said, I think they're saying that people in Europe are less aware and understanding of the concept of the Doe complaint, so it doesn't occur to them.
Okay, well, that also, we could work with, you know, we could try to work with INTA and other groups to make that knowledge known better among European trademark practitioners.
And Susan says so maybe some education to summarize what you suggested.
Yeah, same idea. Okay, so pencil that in too.
This is Harold, so I will move on to this bottom of page 4, top of page 5, SMD file. So the sub-team is tasked to ask all three providers to confirm whether their examiners are able to obtain the jurisdiction information of the trademark category of goods and services based on their response, a working group to determine whether to propose an operational fix. Alternatively, is there any other way to ensure examiners can obtain this trademark information? So what the three providers said, AD and DRC said, they have not relayed any difficulties of obtaining jurisdiction information and category of goods and services. Firm said SMD files are permitted as proof of use evidence and can be uploaded as a part of Firm's online filing process. SMD files are not required as evidence for proof of use. And then MFSB said if any SMD file is submitted with the complaint, it is transmitted to the examiner together with the case file. Once the SMD file is submitted, MFSC also verifies that it has not been revoked. So I don't think they answer the questions very directly, but I see Susan and Michael have their hand raised.
Okay, well, let's hear from them.
Hi. Yeah, hi, it's Susan, just quickly. I think the issue here is, and this is something that I think Colin O'Brien posted to the full mailing list at last week sometime. I think the issue is we're kind of asking the wrong question. I think we perhaps weren't thinking clearly or there was a misunderstanding or even maybe the providers have, but this the SMD file is only for the proof of use. It's not how you find out the details of the jurisdiction of the mark or the goods and services of the mark or so on. And Colin made that point in his email that basically when you bring a URS case, you potentially upload your SMD file as your proof of use or you could upload something else. But you also upload the details of the mark, you know, the registration certificate and so on. So I think this is a really non-point.
Okay, and Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So, Michael Karanikos, for the record. So, I agree that getting hung up on the SMD file specifically is a distraction, but I do think that it's the last aspect of this question, which is a mental thing, which is there another way for the examiners to obtain the jurisdictional and category information other than through the SMD file? If they're not getting it through the SMD file, how are they accessing this information? And I don't see that being answered by in the responses. So are they getting this information, or are they treating it just as a protected string?
Well, let me ask a question. Wouldn't the complainant in their complaint be stating that the complaint is based upon, you know, a trademark, you know, from this such and such jurisdiction for these goods and services? I mean, isn't that part of the complaint that's filed, you know, by the complainant?
So, hi,
they have to demonstrate rights,
yes.
You know, that on which the complaint
yes.
is based.
Bill, yes, that's exactly right. They have to... They do have to upload evidence of their trademark. And Colin sent around a really useful document from the forum, which shows you like what the screen grabs look like when you go to make your complaint and how you upload it and what you have to attach. As I say, I really this This is a non-point.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, you know, it's got to be in the complaint. They have to state that the complaint is based upon their rights, and they have to state what the rights, you know, the basis of the rights. So it's going to be in the original complaint, so far as I can tell. So I tend to agree that. Someone speaking?
All right, well, if it's... Yeah, sorry. Okay, sorry. I didn't raise my hand. Sorry, this is Michael.
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, I see in the email that Colin sent out, I see the classification, but I don't necessarily see the... Yeah, I guess Forum does have the box for the classification of the services, not necessarily the jurisdictional limitations. I don't know. I agree that the question's been phrased a little bit inartfully, and it hasn't really gotten the proper response to this. But I'm happy to move on then.
Yeah, I would just, thanks, Michael. Yeah, why doesn't staff just check the rules? I mean, I'm pretty sure the rules require the complainant to state these elements in the initial complaint. They have to, you know, demonstrate that they have rights on which the complaint is based. So if you could just look into that and get back to us. But if that's going on, I think it's a non-issue. So let's move on to number 8.
Thanks, Phil. And just know Justine put a comment. MSSC's practice of verifying that the submitted MSC file has not been revoked is interesting. I just note that. And move on to the next action item that's on page 5 is for subteam to follow up with MSSC to request evidence to support their claim regarding certain factors being possible deterrents to filing a URS complaint. So staff just quickly check into it remind you what they said. Is that they think limited applicability of URS is a deterrent? It's not a consensus policy. Is that the suspension remedy is not very sufficient, and also the complainant needs to provide a strict burden of proof. So that's what they said. And then they said how they get this information is based on informal feedback of complainants, their authorized representatives. And they also said there's objective data that URS disputes are less used than UDRP, rendering the conclusion that the limited applicability and the remedy are the main reason for that.
Okay, well, my response, I don't see an issue here. We're entering the decisional phase on URS, and we know we've heard from participants in the working group that the major deterrents are the higher burden of proof, which stems from the fact that this is a procedure that's supposed to be used only for black and white cases that can be handled very rapidly, and the limited nature of the remedy, which is just suspension for the remainder of the registration period with one-year extension. So we're really at the point where working group members who think, you know, these deterrents should be addressed in some way by changing the policy are going to have the opportunity over the next week or so to present proposals for working group discussion to address that. So I don't think we need to do anything on this one.
Thanks, Phil. And Susan just put a note about the previous point. It's see page 14 of the forum doc, colon circled, requires a trademark certificate to be uploaded. That's about the SMD file. So no more other comments or hand raised.
Okay.
And sorry, Justine just pasted the U.S. rule about the trademark-related things, and I'm not going to read the whole text, but you can look at the...
Well, that just confirms that the complainant has to put that basic trademark information in the complaint. So if they're following the rule, that's all going to be in there.
Nothing further hands or comments. I guess I would just move on to the next one. It's now on page 5 under B notice. So the subteam is to follow up with Forum and ask why GDPR may make the activation of URF lock more difficult. And they responded, as registries struggle with how to handle the implication of GDPR, Forum has experienced delay in obtaining verification details. A small number of registries do not respond within the required 24 hours.
Yeah, sorry, Ariel,
it's on page 5, and it's under the notice to effect on registry operator.
Okay, well, I think we've already covered that before, that we need a more uniform way for providers and registries to communicate, and the GDPR stuff is in the bailiwick of the EPDP right now. So, you know, it does permit the filing of DOE complaints, and we already discussed how we need to we could suggest some outreach so that European practitioners are more aware of the availability of DOE complaints in the aftermath of GDPR implementation.
And this is Anna. Susan just had a green check, and she agrees with you.
Good. All right, let's move on here to
response
issues.
Yes, that's the bottom of page 5, top of page 6. The action item is for subteam to review Forum's Appendix B and MFSD's checklist used for the administrative review of the response and consider whether further deliberation is needed. The staff put the document in the column 2, and you can click on the hyperlinked phrase to see what the actual document looked like.
Okay. Has staff looked at those documents?
Yes, staff have looked at the documents, but don't really think there's any issues with them.
Okay. I'm willing to accept that judgment on this technical issue. Anyone else?
And this is Aaron. Nobody has raised hand or commented in the AC.
Okay, then let's move on to defenses.
Yes, that's page 6. So, again, that's to review a few documents. So so what the action item is for the working group, actually, to further examine the divergent practice and requirements of providers with regard to examiners providing reasoning in support of determination, and also to consider whether all providers should give similar types or forms of guidance to their examiners. So even that's an action item for the working group. The provider subteam may be called to provide input, so that's why we have this action item listed here. And then you can see all three providers have provided their guidelines for determination, and a forum has the templates for default, final, and appeal determinations. But in fact, staff haven't looked at them in detail, so perhaps it's best for the subteam to review it.
Okay. On this one, don't we already have some preliminary recommendations regarding developing some minimum requirements for what needs to be in a decision? And looking into some uniform guidance.
This is Sarah. Yes, and that's a the proposed recommendation. So that recommendation is actually based on the review of these existing documents and see whether anything new needs to be developed. That's your staff's understanding.
Okay, so we already have a recommendation on this issue that's going to be discussed by the working group probably in the next week or two, and if it's accepted, you know, if it gets through the whole process, and I think it's fairly non-controversial that there ought to be a sentence or two explaining the reason for the decision. It should be more than just saying I find the elements to be satisfied. That the actual details of that would be worked, if it's in the final report, would be worked out by the implementation team. So I think we've already addressed this. What do others think?
And Michael just put in a chat, the ADNDRC guidelines don't appear to contain any consideration of defenses. And no other hands.
Okay. Well, Michael, on that one, if we recommend some kind of uniform guidance for all examiners, that could be addressed through that.
Yeah, I think that's good. Hang on. I'm just looking at this again now, and it looks like they've just sent us a single determination as opposed to any sort of standards. It looks like this is just a form, basically like a template that they could just plug and paste in terms of formulating their decisions, which is troubling. And again, I didn't look at this before the call, but looking at this now, if this is what they're providing in terms of their guideline, this is just a form version of a decision that they can just cut and paste in, is what it looks like. But yes, I think that a recommendation along the lines you mentioned about proper education for how this is supposed to work is a good recommendation.
So basically ADN is to provide us a document that's not really fully responsive to our request, and I note Susan agreed with that in the chat and also agreed that the existing proposal for minimum standards is one that we'd support. I assume that's Validaeus. And as I said, you know, my recollection is that that was a non-controversial proposal. Everyone agreed that it wouldn't be burdensome and it would be proper to set some minimum requirements for a decision across all providers. So I think that's one that will be readily accepted by the working group when we get to that in the next week or two. So I think we're good on this one.
And this is Vera. There's just some chats. So Susan says that they don't really seem to be guidelines. So we would feel that existing proposals for minimum standards is one which supports two. And just think that's one that applies across board, yes. And Susan said, yes, Validaeus would, but I was imagining the substitute. But that's just the remaining of the chat, and we can move on to the next page.
Yeah, just want to ask, Susan, when you say sub, is that referring to subpro or something else?
Sorry, I should have just spoken. I think the proposal for the minimum standards or guidelines or whatever came from one of the other subs, like the data the documents one. And I was just saying I can't see that anything that's come out of what we've been doing in this provider subteam would take us apart. I think in this provider subteam, it seems to me we're also in agreement with that proposal.
Okay. Yeah, again, I think it's non-controversial that when a decision says that we found that, you know, the registrant has, registered and used the domain in bad faith, for the requisite burden of proof, that there should be an additional sentence or two saying, because we found this and this, and that's what convinced us. So it's not burdensome, and it would be very useful if there's any a future review of URF to make sure the decisions are being issued correctly. So we're done on that one. Okay, GDP, other topics.
That's on the bottom of page 6, top of page 7. So the subteam is to ask GDD and registry operator with regard to the HSTS preloaded domain suspension issue and potential GDPR impacts on providers' ability to check the completion of URS actions by registry operators. Because we're going to send out the sunrise and trademark claims survey very soon to registry operators, so we didn't ask them yet because we don't want to overload them with all the questions. But GDD did respond to these questions, so they're aware of the challenge related to the HSTS preloaded domain suspension and is working on alternative methods to support this technology. And also they said about, you know, checking whether registry operators have completed URS actions. Since the name server domain status data is not personal data, URS providers can still check who is to obtain this information. And they can also visit the website associated with the domain, which should be redirected to a web page that shows it's suspended. And so then the three providers, they followed up on this matter. They also said they request registry operators to change the U.S. suspended domain server to point to their DNS server to ensure it resolves to the suspension page. That's their responses.
Okay, so it seems to me that to the extent there's a problem here, it fits in with our recommendation we've already discussed for more education of registries and making sure there's uniform ways to communicate between the providers and registries. And so far as checking whether the suspension has been accomplished, I think GDD pointed out all you need to do is type in the domain name in a web browser, and in 2 seconds you'll know whether it's been redirected properly.
And this is Aaron. No comments or a hand raised about this point.
Okay. All right, let's move on to language issues. That's probably a little meatier.
That's on bottom of page 7, top of page 8. The subteam is to ask ADNDRC how their examiner's language skills are used in U.S. proceedings where the respondents are not English speakers, if any, and ask ADNDRC how their examiners handle the situation, if any, where a respondent didn't have the capability of understanding English. So their response is all their U.S. decisions are rendered in English, but most of their examiners speak Chinese or other Asian languages in addition to English. But their skills are not used in U.S. proceedings, but often used in UDRP proceedings. They haven't encountered any situation that the respondent didn't have the capability of understanding English.
Michael, go ahead.
Thanks. I don't really draw a lot of comfort from ADNDRC's response here, especially considering the proportion of cases that are defaulting. So for them to turn around and say, well, you know, we haven't heard back that people can't understand. I mean, if you're getting defaults in anyway, I know that that information would be forthcoming. I think that ADNDRC is overwhelmingly dealing with registrants who are mostly speaking Chinese or Korean. So I don't understand why they're not, given that they're examiners presumably also speak Chinese, I don't understand why they wouldn't be working in the language in which the registration was made. So I think that we should have as a suggestion here that they should be working in the language in which the registration was made.
Yeah, Michael, on that point, maybe you know, or maybe staff or another person on the call can remind me, what are the current URS requirements regarding the notice to the, you know, the filing, you know, what are the language requirements? Can the complaint be filed in a language other than English? Does the, I believe the registrant's supposed to get a notice in the language they use for the registration. I forget how the proceedings are supposed to go. Can someone remind me of what the current rules are for URS regarding language?
This is Ariel from staff. I think we will take that as an action item just to double check the URS rules, and then we can report this back to the sub-team.
Okay. You know, I'm still a little, it may not be an issue. We found with ADN, sometimes we think there's an issue, and then when we ask again, it turns out they've misunderstood. But, you know, the ability to speak Chinese or another Asian language is very different than the ability to write in a language. But lots of people have speaking skills who can't write in a particular, in the same language. And it's kind of odd that they use Chinese and other languages in their UDRP proceedings, but have never used it in URS. So I think we need some further drilling down on that. And then compare it against the current language provisions of URS and consider whether we need any suggestion there. And obviously, since we're opening the proposal period for URS and it's going to only be open for 10 days, 2 weeks or so, we need that feedback. If staff could get back on that later today on that narrow question, it would be very useful given the timeliness of the stage we're at.
This is Ariel. I just want to note that Michael has to put the relevant URS rules in the chat, and actually we'll also double-check the rules. It's mainly rule number 9, language of proceedings. The U.S. procedure paragraph 4.2 specifies the language in which the notice of complaint should be transmitted. The complaint should be submitted in English. The response may be provided in English or in one of the languages used for notice of complaint. And 10C, the examiner appointed shall be fluent in English and in the language of response and will determine in which language to issue its determination in its sole discretion. In the absence of response, the language of determination should be English. The provider is not responsible for translating any documents other than the notice of complaint.
Okay, so I'm reading that. So it says that the provider is responsible for translating the notice of complaint, but how do they know what language to translate it to? And it would seem from ADN's response that they're not doing those translations. Okay.
This is Ariel.
See, Susan just answered that question. So, it seems to me that, if a registrant doesn't speak or read English, and, you know, let's say they're in Vietnam or they're in China or Korea and they only speak the native language and read and write in the native language of their country, that getting the complaint in English isn't going to be very helpful. So I think there is some issue here because ADN seems to be saying they don't bother translating the complaint into the language of the registrant's country. Susan, go ahead.
Sorry, I was trying to read the previous questions that we asked, because of course this question wasn't asking them if they translate the complaint. This question is asking them about their examiners and the examiner's skills and things. So, I think we perhaps need to just double check that we haven't already had an answer to that about translating it. And I'm trying to find it while I was talking, so I'll keep looking.
Okay. Well, if you can find it, or if not, if staff can look into this and get back to us today, given the imminence of accepting, you know, looking at proposals. It's, you know, the rules, I can't see a reason to propose a change in the rules, but at a minimum, we ought to make sure that the registrant's getting a copy of the complaint in a language they can understand, and then it's up to them whether to respond or not. But we wouldn't want to see them getting a complaint they have no comprehension of, and that's the reason for default.
And this is Ariel. I have my hand raised to answer your question about translating, and ADN DRC doesn't. They don't translate any document. They communicate only in English. That's what their response previously.
Okay, well, that's, I think then that's an action item for, you know, we've seen in other places where ADN just ignores parts of the policy that they find inconvenient, and that's troubling. Susan, do you have further comment? And also, same for Michael. Susan first.
Sorry, old hand. But I was just saying, though, in that case, then, that seems, like you say, that the ADNV aren't following the procedure properly, it would appear.
Okay,
yeah,
Michael?
I think that you, sorry. Yeah, I think you put your finger on the solution there is they're not following the policy and they need to. It does say in their response that their examiners speak other languages, because of course they do, but they don't, these skills are not used in the proceedings at all, which suggests to me that it's not being done. But I think we have the solution, so no need to belabor this.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think this just goes along with a general recommendation that ICANN needs to be aware that one of their accredited providers is just ignoring certain URS policy points, and that needs to be corrected. You know, it's good that we have a provider in Asia. There's a lot of domain registrants in Asia, but if they're not doing basic things like, following the rules for how you convey the notice to the registrant or doing the translation that's required, they're not doing a good job. And it needs to be, they need to follow the rules. So I think we've beaten that one to death, and let's, is there another one here on MFSD? Feasible to mandate sending registry and registrar notice in the same languages. And MFSD said it would be burdensome. Yeah, and MFSD, I'll note in passing, they're operating in the European Union. They're probably dealing with 20 different languages there. They may also be dealing with different scripts. They could well be dealing with Cyrillic scripts in some of the cases.
Others on that? No hand raised or comment about this point, but just note that Michael said in the Adobe Connect, does there need to be some sort of auditing to catch this going forward? And I think he's referring to the previous point about language. And there's not a hand, but and there's some chat in the...
I see Susan's response, and I'd agree. Yeah, we need to bring this situation with ADN to ICANN's attention and recommend that they tell them they need to come into compliance and they need to look at what they're doing, you know, after some period, a reasonable period, to give them time to comply and make sure they're complying. Otherwise, they're just this goes to a basic issue of whether the registrant is getting the notice and is getting a notice they understand. So it's pretty fundamental to, we still may see a high default rate, but we don't want it because they're not ever getting the notice or because they're getting one they can't read because it's in English and they have no idea what it says. I think that it's non-controversial and we all on this call agree on that. So let's move on to education and training.
This is Ariel. So that's on page 8 and page 9. And the action item is to ask subteam to review the notice of complaint and provider's online forms instructions before considering whether any recommendations should be made. So I just want to remind subteam why this action item is made is because there's a proposed recommendation to create some kind of education or training for U.S. parties to understand the process. And then when we discussed this point with the providers, MFSC said there's already information out there on the website and on the notice of complaint. And then the providers, they have instructions to help the U.S. parties to understand how the proceeding goes. So that's why we're requested to review the existing information and determine whether recommendations should be made. And all the information that provided in column 2, and they're hyperlinked in the column there. So you can look at the complaint form, response form, appeal form, and notice of complaint from all three providers.
Okay, let me say one thing and ask one question. I noticed that both, and this relates back to the discussion we just had, I note that both the form and the MFSD send a copy of the complaint both in English and the predominant language of the registrant's country or territory, and ADN is conspicuous in not doing that, as we already determined. I haven't looked at all these forms. Have staff looked at them? Did they meet the minimum requirements, or did you see any areas we might want to comment on or make recommendations on?
And this is Ariel. We can take this as an action item to review it more in detail, but through a quick glimpse, we didn't see a lot of problems. And I just want to note one thing is that when we look at the ADN-DRC complaint form, they said they don't accept the complaint that do not meet all the requirements, but we noticed there are some fields that are not mandatory, for example, like fax number for the complainant. But that could be a minor issue, but we're happy to take a look at them in detail and report if there's any issues we should bring up to the subteam.
Okay, thank you. Further comments on that one, or can we move on? And we've been going an hour, and we're almost done. So good. We're nearing.
No more hands.
I thought this was 10 pages, but it's actually 12. But we're 3/4 of the way through.
This is Sarah. Now we're bottom of page 9 and top of page 10, actually to page 11 too. It's to ask ADN-DRC to elaborate on their panel selection process. So just to remind you why we asked this question is that they said because the domain dispute area is a niche area in Asia, so their process should remain flexible but not rigorous, so that's why the action item was triggered. And now they provided more detailed response. Is their panel selection process is kind of categorized into two different types. One is for non-invited candidates, and the other is for the invited candidates. So for the non-invited candidates, interested candidates can contact ADN-DRC Secretariat office or any of the four offices with their detailed CV or resume. And the ADN-DRC panel selection committee, including the chairman of ADN-DRC, and they will evaluate these applications. And then for their selection criteria for the non-invited candidates, they include substantial arbitration and or intellectual property experience.
Yeah. I've been scanning those. I don't know that you have to read each and every one of those points.
So I'll just skip all these.
The one that caught my eye is that if you're older than 75, you can't be an examiner for them, but I don't know what the rules are on age discrimination in the jurisdictions where they operate. But I'm not sure that's an issue for us. But, you know, it all looks good to me. The key is how do they apply it, and it's very difficult to know how they actually apply it. But I think the bottom line is they invite people who they think are eminent people with astute knowledge and vast experience. And if you're not invited, you can still apply, and they have all these criteria, and we really don't have a way to evaluate how they apply those criteria. On the other hand, we haven't heard any complaints that people who want to be examiners for them are being blocked. Further thoughts from anybody on that?
And this is Ariel. Susan just said the ADNDRC process looks pretty positive.
Yeah, I would agree. When you look at the criteria, there are multiple criteria, and they look good, you know, and we don't really have a way to know how they're applied. That's a kind of a behind-the-door process. But on paper, it looks satisfactory. I don't see a recommendation coming out of that.
And this is Ira. There's no other hands. And Suzanne agrees with you.
Okay.
And move on to the next action item. That's on page 11. It's a sub-team working group to examine MFSD dispute number 8422F178 and number 429EC571. So the reason for the action item is we asked whether any of your examiners drawn inferences per U.S. Rule 12F when the party is not in compliance with U.S. rules, procedures, and supplemental rules, and in the absence of exceptional circumstances. So MFSD said yes, and then they provided these two disputes. They draw the inferences to U.S. Rule 12F. But then when Brian asked us about why this action item is made this way on the mailing list, the staff responded about the origin, and then he said this looks to be fairly standard language as to an examiner drawing an inference for whatever worth.
Okay, anyway, I'm having a little difficulty understanding what this one is about. Maybe Susan can enlighten us. I see her hand up.
I don't think I can. I'm going to ask a question, which is, so did we ask this question of MFSG, and did they answer? Because I can't see an answer. Or was it decided not to ask it because Brian said he thought that was standard language? Is that what you were saying?
This is Ariel. Probably I can clarify this. So this is not a follow-up question. It's more like a response from the first round of question we sent to them, and then this is the action item for the sub-team to review these two disputes. But the sub-team hasn't got a chance to do it yet, so we thought this might be a good opportunity to tackle this all together. So it's not a follow-up response from MFSD.
Okay, and, I haven't looked at this particular dispute, but does staff know what inference was drawn in this dispute? I mean, what are we looking at here? I'm still a little confused on this one. I see I think we're all scratching our heads on this one.
This is Ariel. So the inference that examiners drawn is Rule 12F. I will just paste the 12F in the chat here so you can read the text.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so what inference would an examiner usually deem appropriate to to make if a party is not in compliance with any part of the rules, procedures, and supplemental rules. Okay, I'm reading Susan's thing in the chat. All right, well, we're not going to review those cases right now, and that's one case. It's hard to generalize from a single case, but it's basically about default, and that says here that what MFSD said, if there's a no response, that permits an inference that the complainant's reasonable allegations are true, and also may permit the examiner to infer that the respondent doesn't deny, which is related to that. So, yeah, they you don't automatically lose a default case, but it's not going to be you're not going to get anything positive out of that. It's not the same as asserting a affirmative defense in a case. They still may be a reason, just in some UDRP decisions where the complainant loses even a default. And Michael says, I think the issue is to make sure the burden of proof remains firmly on the complainant. You know, Michael, I think that would be addressed if we, you know, create some minimum requirements for what has to be in the decision. We're going to get decisions that state why the examiner believed the burden of proof was met. That's all I have to say on that one.
And this is Harold. And just things that still don't understand the concept here, I don't see an issue with examiner being allowed to draw inferences from the party's noncompliance. And then as Susan said, I think it's just that they give us some examples of where this had happened. So for completeness, we should review.
Okay.
I guess we can move on to the next.
I think so.
Next is on page 11. The action item is to ask AD and DRC to provide details in order to understand whether they have been out of compliance with technical requirements. The reason for this action item is they said they yes. They have been out of compliance with technical requirements, and then the detail is because their website was under maintenance, due to which they were facing difficulties in complying with the URS technical requirements. Now the website is up to running, and so they're in compliance. That's their response.
It's Susan. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So I think we've already got a kind of general feeling that we need some kind of recommendation about ICANN auditing for compliance of the rules generally. And this just seems to fall within the scope of that as well to me. It sounds like they say they're in compliance now. One would like to think that compliance gets checked from time to time.
I'd agree with that.
This is Aaron. There's no more hands or comments about this point.
Okay, then let's move on.
Next one is still ask AD&DRC to provide details on the information or data that ICANN requested from them via their regular communications. So they just provided two emails, they are exchanged with ICANN. So basically just providing examples of what they communicate with ICANN about, while the other examiner provided a list of things they communicated with ICANN.
Okay, I don't see any recommendation arising out of that. Anyone else?
And so Susan says, sorry, my Adobe connection.
No, I think that was on the previous one.
Right, right.
Yeah, old comments, that's what I thought.
So if there's no more discussion about this point, I guess we can move on. So the next action item is to ask all three providers to provide specific examples of their examiner training and education programs materials to assist the working group to determine whether further deliberation is needed. And so all three providers provided some examples. They're specifically PowerPoint slides for their training programs for their examiners. So staff did a quick review of these, and we think these are pretty good information. We don't think there's any further issue to raise, but defer to the sub-team to determine.
I don't see any further action required, but anyone else differ on that? All right, last item.
Last item is just ask ADNDRC to confirm whether any of their examiner voluntarily disclosed any conflict of interest. They said no. And that's the same as Forum said yes, but there's no problem raised because of it. So we don't see any further issue about this either.
Okay, yeah, I would agree. We hope that their examiners are of sufficient character that if they had a conflict, they'd reveal it, but we have no evidence that any URS has been decided by examiner later found to have had a conflict. So I think we're done. I think we had two or three fairly minor items coming out of this, and maybe one or two places where staff was going to take a little deeper dive and get back to us in the next 24 hours. Is that a correct characterization?
Yes, this is Ariel, and staff have captured notes and proposed suggestions. So what we suggest to do is we can perhaps update the super consolidated document by including the proposed suggestions from the sub-team that's captured in today's call, because we understand the working group is going to use that document to review all the sub-team proposals. And then we will get back to the sub-team about the action items for staff for the deeper dive.
Right. And when co-chairs have a call with staff tomorrow, we're going to discuss what, if anything, we have to do to with the recommendations that are in the super consolidated document to format them to accord to the form in which we discussed on the working group call yesterday, which there's not that many, and I think it's mainly a quick cut and paste job on each of them. They're all based on lots of data. They didn't come out of thin air, but that'll be a topic of discussion for the co-chair staff call tomorrow. So if we could have that updated document by tomorrow for co-chair's use, that would be excellent.
This is Ari, as noted. We'll get this done ASAP today.
Super. Well, we're 11 minutes before. We have 11 minutes to give back to everyone. And I think we're pretty, this is the last of the follow-up on URS subteam. So well done and very thorough job. Any last words from anyone else? All right, class dismissed. Thank you. We'll look forward to a follow-up email from staff and an update of the super consolidated document for use on the co-chair's call tomorrow. Thank you. Bye now.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks all for joining. This concludes today's call. The recordings will be disconnected. Have a great remainder of your day.